Welcome to Next Economy Now. The goal of this podcast series is to highlight the leaders who are taking a regenerative, bioregional, equitable, democratic, racially just, and whole systems approach to creating the new economy.
I'm Ryan Honeyman, a partner at Lyft Economy. My guest today is Marjorie Kelly. Marjorie is a thought leader in next-generation enterprise design, employee ownership, impact investing, and the building of a community-rooted democratic economy. She's a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. Kelly's the author of four books, the most recent of which is Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises, published last year in 2023. Her other books, which are all excellent, I encourage folks to read, include The Divine Right of Capital in 2001, Owning Our Future in 2012, and The Making of a Democratic Economy in 2019. At the Democracy Collaborative, Kelly's work has focused on advancing employee ownership, for example, working with her team to design and help launch the Fund for Employee Ownership at the Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland. Her team has also led research in next-generation private enterprise, studying and convening 50-plus companies that are employee-owned B corporations, delivering superior social and environmental impacts. She's convened leaders building a next system of capital, helping community foundations do place-based investing, and led the Learning Action Lab for Community Wealth Building, helping Native American organizations build wealth in Indigenous communities. Marjorie, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Quite an amazing list of accomplishments there, and that's not even the whole bio. So thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for everything you do.
You know, I've had such good luck to be involved in the wonderful projects I've been involved in. I'm summarizing, what have I learned? What can we all learn from these many, many visionaries? And that's what I'm talking about in Wealth Supremacy.
Awesome. Well, maybe before we jump in, you know, folks who don't know much about your background and how you first got interested in the work today, you just tell us, like, how did you come to doing what you're doing now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really started back in my 30s. I was working at a publishing company in charge of new projects, and I started to see some interesting stuff happening in business and investing. This didn't seem like my father's business world. I mean, there was divestment from South Africa. They were teaching ethics in business schools. And I thought, you know, something's happening here. I'd love to see more of this happen. I'd like to kind of put myself in the middle of it as a journalist. So I left my job. I stepped off a cliff and I launched Business Ethics Magazine, which was about socially responsible business and investing. And I published that for 20 years. And it really did put me in the middle, as you know, as a journalist, it's your job to sort of be in the middle of what's happening. And over time, I became discouraged. I thought that good business people, good investors could change the world. And I saw over and over again how social mission was driven out when big capital got involved, when companies were acquired, when they went public. Invariably, they reverted to the norm, which is maximum gains for capital. So I left there. I sold the magazine and I moved to Telus Institute in Boston and I did some consulting there. And we talked about, well, how else would you design corporations if not for maximum profit? And we convened a number of people on that. And then after a number of years, I joined the Democracy Collaborative. Really, I had come to see that ownership, really the foundational control and ownership is where the power lies. And that's what needs to be redesigned. So I've been at the Collaborative now for over a decade, Ryan, and I've been involved in these incredible projects, visionary people, doing impact investing and economic development and next generation enterprise. And yet we're not moving the needle. We're not moving the needle. And so, in fact, things are worse rather than better. Over my career of more than 30 years, I've seen companies become more rapacious. I've seen, you know, companies that I once give business ethics awards to would do, I think it's called an inversion, where you pretend that you're headquartered in Ireland or somewhere so as to evade taxes, you know, and demanding tax cuts just to stay in a community where you've been for 100 years doing massive layoffs. So these things that used to be frowned upon and kind of taboo suddenly became the norm. And I wanted to know why. And, you know, again, it's about capital. Capital becomes more and more rapacious over time because the bigger the sphere of financial assets gets, the more extractive it needs to become in order to get bigger still. And so it was this large aggregate phenomenon happening that I didn't see people talking about. And I wanted to talk about it in this book. In a nutshell, let me say one thing, Ryan, and that is, because I know your listeners are trying to build the next economy, trying to work for the positive. And I've done that my entire career. It's not enough to build the positive. It's not. They're tearing down what we build faster than we build it. And they're doing something else much, much, much faster than what we're doing. So we need to turn and discredit and delegitimize the extractive system. And until we do that, it's going to devour everything that we build.
And so that kind of brings us to the idea of wealth supremacy. So could you talk about that and maybe a little bit about how you came to write the book?
Yes, I think it's really important to name phenomena so that we can begin to talk about it. We have phrases like greed and corporate power and inequality, and we point to those as the problem, or even climate change. But none of those really get to the root dysfunction of the capital-centric system. And that root dysfunction is what I have termed wealth supremacy. And it's a deliberate echo of white supremacy. It's a form of bias, and it tends to be invisible and unconscious, as bias is, until we name it and recognize it and call it out. Because until we do, it's considered normal. It's considered normal that only capital, only wealthy people have a vote inside corporations. Workers are not members of the corporation. That's capital bias. A worker can work somewhere for 40 years, making the products, you know, they're running the company, they're outsiders. A hedge fund holding shares for 15 minutes, they're insiders. They have a vote. This is one example of what I call capital bias. This is how it's integrated in the daily workings of the system. And wealth supremacy is this root cultural norm that wealthy people are more important than the rest of us. You know, they're protecting their assets, growing their assets, a rising stock market, you know, the ability to influence politics and philanthropy, all of that, that's all wealth privilege. And we just accept it as normal. And what I'm saying by naming it wealth supremacy is I'm saying, no, it's a form of bias and it's not legitimate.
You know, I'm really glad you're pointing this out. I organized a panel at SOCAP conference, Social Capital Markets, for folks who don't know, in 2019 with a couple folks, Kate Poole and Tiffany Brown from Cordata Capital and Nwamaka Agbo who's now at the Katali Foundation. And the session was on why market rate returns are perpetuating white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was, even at this social investment conference, where we're talking about how do we invest in women and people of color, most of the investors there still wanted, quote unquote, market rate returns in addition to their impact. And it seems like that's what you're pointing at. Could you speak to that, return bias?
Yeah. That's a good one, Ryan. That's a good example of capital bias, of wealth supremacy, because market rate returns means preserve the status quo. Act like everybody else. Don't get out of line. If men hold all the power and women are, you know, confined to the home, well, don't rock the boat. Keep the status quo. That's bias. That's bias. And so, yeah, I saw a survey that 2/3 of even impact investors, who are the most radical investors, really trying to have positive social and ecological impact, 2/3 say they want market rate returns. And so what I talk about in the book, at a Democracy Collaborative, we hired 3 international economists to look at this phenomenon that is called financialization. And economists have warned about this for decades, even economists at the International Monetary Fund. This is not a fringe phenomenon, but it tends to be limited to academic circles. But what they're saying is that there's too much financial wealth in the world in too few hands. We know that there's 8 or 10 billionaires owned about 40% of the world's wealth. And yet the systems say they're, you know, maximizing their returns is the aim of the system, and their wealth has to grow perpetually. So when you say market rate returns, what you're saying is preserving the status quo, where the wealthy are getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, that matters more than having a livable earth or a fair society. And we need to challenge that, Ryan. We need to challenge ourselves, those of us who have are fortunate enough to have an investment portfolio. We need to ask, well, what is done on behalf of those returns? And recognize that wealth these days, because there's far too much of it, financial wealth is growing by extraction, just throwing workers out of work, raising rents. Overseas, developing countries are struggling because they have to pay bondholders first and they can't feed their people. So this norm that capital comes first and market rate returns, which are based on this principle of maximization, that's the problem. And so if we're going to preserve the problem, we're not going to solve it. You know, it's like saying, well, yeah, you know, women can have some rights, but men need to still hold all the power. No, that's not how it works.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I think many folks don't know, and maybe you could speak to this, is around like the creation of money and how that the attachment of debt to the creation of money is one of the ways that it creates the snowball effect of, you know, wealth supremacy in many ways. Could you speak a little bit about, maybe I'll just say this, is Edgar Villanueva, I believe, wrote the foreword for your current book.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. He wrote the foreword for our last book, The Next Economy MBA. So love Edgar. You know, he talks about money as medicine. Like money is neutral. It's just energy. And I do believe that. And at the same time, there is like the creation of money creates debt, which then has to be paid back and extracted, you know, from somewhere. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to this idea of like money and that the debt is created by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a number of ways in which financial capital receives an ongoing gain. And one is through the creation of debt. So every asset held by one person is a claim against someone or something else. You know, when there's credit card debt, that's a claim on your checkbook. Or you hold a share of stock in a company, that's a claim on the value of the company. And in order to drive up that value, which is the bottom line, it often means laying off workers or paying workers as little as possible or turning full-time jobs into gig work or cutting benefits. There's all kinds of ways that taking money systematically shifted from labor to capital. And with debt, money is systematically shifted from, say, consumers to capital. And that's right. So even issuing debt means that it has to be paid back. And so the money grows. But even more than that, I mean, if you have modest rates of interest, I think that you don't have to get rid of debt. I mean, let's not be black and white about this. But when capital is growing faster than GDP, which it generally is, right? I mean, the S&P last year, I think, returned, what, 25%? Something like that. And GDP is 2 or 3%. So where does that money come from? Where does the rest of that come from? Well, it comes from extracting from other people, from society, from the planet. And this is something that we need to start talking about.
Yeah. And it seems like in society now, the way that our supply chains are so expanded and everything's so far away that it's hard for people to really understand, like, oh, I have Amazon stock and I went from $100 that I had in Amazon stock and I got $200. Like, this is great. But folks don't see what happened there.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have this myth in our culture that investment money just falls from the sky. It's pristine. It's unblemished. The numbers go up. That's great. You always want them to go up more rather than less. And that blindness is built into the way investment returns are presented to us. And we don't have to see what's being done on behalf of that money. It doesn't fall from the sky. It's extracted. These international economists that we hire will be publishing their paper soon, this paper on financialization. And what they pointed out is that the problem is not just that wealth is unequal. We talk about that a lot. We always hear statistics about how billionaire wealth is going up and everybody else's wealth is stagnant or falling, or they don't have any. But the more important point these economists made is that wealth is the driver of inequality. It is creating inequality because it's throwing people out of work or loading them with debt. And these various forms, I mean, you know, we're told that we're in a trickle-down economy, right? There's the makers of wealth, and everybody else hopes that a few little drops of it will trickle down and fall on us. The reverse is true. It's a suctioning upward. That wealth is coming from suctioning and extracting from the rest of us, from society, from the planet. And this is not how we're told to talk about wealth.
You know, if I were to take this to the personal for me, I'm curious what your thoughts are on. So for me, when I think about money and wealth, even being in a next economy mindset, there's part of me that thinks I need just a little bit more in order to feel more safe. And so can you talk about, like, I feel that there's these concepts of money that are also representative of like some sort of psychological safety or some sort of like addressing some sort of trauma. And I'm wondering, can we even get to the place of identifying money in these systems without addressing some of that psychological safety and trauma underneath?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. There's a lot that's tied up in this. So I like to make analogy to climate change, because those of us who can remember when Al Gore's movie first came out, Inconvenient Truth, I mean, he had been going around with his slideshow, putting up these arcane charts about, you know, climate emissions are climbing and it creates a greenhouse effect and it's going to destabilize weather patterns. It was this enormous problem. It was frightening and it blew our minds. And initially, people were saying, well, what's the alternative? We're going to freeze in the dark, right? If we can't drive our cars and we can't heat our homes, we're going to freeze in the dark. Well, no, we have, because we recognized the scale of the problem, the emergency that we are up against. Millions of people around the world have been working on solutions, and we're finding, you know, I purchased community solar. So the home, my home is, electricity comes from community solar. You know, so we're finding solutions. No, we're not going to freeze in the dark. We're going to find our way forward. It's the same with this. I mean, it becomes frightening and you think, well, nobody can have any wealth. And oh my God, that's terrible. No, I mean, we all deserve to have some assets. We all deserve to have financial security. And in fact, you know, if those 10 billionaires didn't have half the money, there'd be more to go around for the rest of us. There would be more stability. There would be more safety. There would be more security. We could send our kids to college. We could buy a home. You know, if you didn't have some wealthy people investing in homes as assets, they're driving up the prices of homes. Private equities out there are now buying homes and bundling them for mortgages and driving up rents and keeping the rest of us from being able to buy homes. And so if wealth were not concentrated in such few hands, it could be spread more evenly and there would be more security.
You know, one of the things I feel sometimes cautious about and hesitant about is on the left, we often connect like wealthy people or the 10 billionaires at the top as like the problem. And part of me feels like there's some danger in that, even though there may be a lot of truth to it. For me, there's a danger in us sort of I'm not saying you're doing this, but I'm just speaking to some of the potential dehumanization of like these other just like wealthy, like fat cats who are sort of like running everything. Mm-hmm. And I just worry about the disconnection from the humanity of like, these are just good people also who are struggling to do their thing. They're just ending up harming a lot of people in what they do, but they're not necessarily evil or something. So I just, you know, yeah.
So my immediate response, first of all, is something that they say in Buddhism, which there are traps and snares everywhere. So when we try to walk into understanding this problem, we have fears, we have misunderstandings, you know, we're looking for scapegoats and people to blame. And so I think what I'm trying to suggest in the book is just seeing clearly, I don't blame individuals. It's a system problem. It can't be solved by individuals alone. It's not caused by individuals alone. In fact, I have a chapter where I talk about this, that if tomorrow aliens abducted all of the fat cats, all the billionaires, all the CEOs of major corporations, all the hedge fund executives, if all of them were abducted by aliens tomorrow, it wouldn't change a thing because new people would step in, the rules of the game would remain the same, and everything would go on. It would not change one thing. So no, this is not about a few bad guys. I mean, I think that's a human impulse. We want to find someone to blame. We want to find the bad guy. This is not about bad guys. And I think we learned this in tackling white supremacy, right? Of course, there are some people who show up as the bad guys and who are being more racist than everybody else. But white supremacy dwells in all of us, particularly in white people. Yes. And so recognizing that it's this form of systemic bias and that changing our own minds, our own hearts, is integral to the change rather than a hunt for villains. It would be so much simpler if there were just villains and if they were breaking the rules and we could capture them. But it's not that simple. It's built into the design of the system. And I talk a lot in the book of how it's on autopilot. We're in a new era of capitalism, which is financial asset capitalism. This is, you know, when you fiduciary duty says, I have an obligation as a wealth manager to maximize my client's wealth. I mean, corporate governance says only capital has a seat at the table and we have to maximize gains to shareholders. So there are all these rules and norms in the system. I call them myths that hold it all in place and tell us it's normal, it's technical. It just has to be this way. And that's where the problem lies. And that's the system that we need to look at and challenge and change.
So glad you used that story about removing all the sort of fat cats, because you can say the same thing about, like, remove all the racists, right, from our system, or remove all the explicitly racist people and you still have racism, right, for the effects of white supremacy. And so that was a good, I like that analogy. You know, I did want to ask one question about growth. You know, we've often heard about too much growth on planet Earth and like growth at all costs. And I talked to Vincent Stanley at Patagonia, and I asked him on one podcast, I said, what if Patagonia grew 0%? Like, could you stop growing? And he's like, that's actually, you don't actually want that, even for a company that doesn't want to grow, because it stagnates. And there's like, you know, even nature grows at, I think, a certain percent per year. Like the forest grows like 4% per year. So how do you reconcile, like, you're not advocating for we need to stop growth and like reverse grow, but like, how do you think about growth and in terms of like business growth or other things in relation to this wealth supremacy topic?
Yeah, I think the main problem of growth is growth of financial assets. I mean, the system is built on this premise that no amount of wealth is ever enough. I call it the myth of maximizing. It's the core premise of the system. Even if you're Bill Gates at one point had $10 billion, which is none of us can even count that high. What did he do? He invested it. 2 decades later, he had $130 billion. That's considered normal in the system. No matter how much wealth you have, you invest it because you need more. So that is where the real growth monster lies. And it lies in our idea that investment portfolios need to go up a maximum amount forever. So let's say that we saw through that myth and said, well, that's kind of absurd, actually, and that comes before all other human values and natural values. And let's say that we, and this is what Kate Raworth, the economist who wrote Donut Economics, what she's saying is, no, you know, we have to recognize that the planet has limits. There's really only one system, and that's life on Earth. That's the system. And we need to live within it. And it has boundaries, and we need to honor those boundaries. It's kind of like aging. You might think you want to, you know, live like you're 25, but you're going to hit the boundaries of being in an aging body. We're hitting the boundaries of an overburdened planet, and we have to live within them. That's the imperative, not growing our maximum portfolios. That's a delusion that can go on forever. And so let's say that honoring planetary boundaries comes first. Let's say, and also honoring social boundaries, like no one should go hungry. You know, people should have places to live. No one should be left out of well-being. So what if we said those came first and we built an economy for that? Well, corporations would have a new mandate to serve the public good. You still need to break even or make some money. I ran a small company 20 years. Yeah, you have to have more money coming in than going out. That's an imperative. That's nothing evil about that. So imagine if companies said, well, we have to get rid of plastics. And so we have to devise new ways of packaging. And they say, we have to get rid of these toxic chemicals. And so we'd have to devise new ways of doing this and that. Business would figure it out. I often think about this. I mean, business people are brilliant. They're given a task and rewarded for achieving it. They will figure it out. And so can we have growth? Well, yeah, you can have growth of services. You can have growth of education. There's lots of things that can grow. But what can't grow is toxic pollution or, you know, plastic. So there are lots of things that can't grow. And so we need to get smart about it. But I think it really comes down to not so much focusing on growth, but focusing on what's the purpose of activity, which is human well-being and a livable planet. And once we set that as the purpose, other things like growth, I think, will find their new level.
You know, a lot of folks have reached out to us and maybe even to you because of this book or other books around, well, what should I do with my retirement account? Mm-hmm. Or like, what should I do? You know, my mom still texts me like, have you seen I don't have any money in Wall Street investments because of not really believing that it's a good system. But my mom's like, you know, so there's this feeling, there's also a narrative of like, you need to be saving for retirement based on this model of the stock market grows every year. If you're smart, you put away X amount of money and then you'll have X amount more money when you retire. And so I'm curious, what advice do you give to folks for retirement?
Yeah. Well, many of us, first of all, it's fine to have some assets and it's fine to want to see those invested and grow to some extent. I'm fortunate to have just a little bit of retirement savings and I have some of it in Wall Street. You know, I wish I didn't. I also drive a car with an internal combustion engine. I wish I didn't. I'm not there yet. I'm not going to throw out a perfectly good car and buy an EV. So, you know, I have a furnace in the basement. I wish I had like some other form of heating. I'm doing what I can, but we're not all there yet. It's a collective issue. So the first thing I think to do, recognize the limitations of where you are. We all have to remain in reality, right? So for example, we have a 403b plan at our nonprofit, and you only have certain selections. We chose socially responsible mutual funds, and so we can move our funds between them. But most of even the responsible funds are invested in Wall Street. But, you know, that's what's available to me. And so that's what I work with. You know, if I have some things outside of the 403B, I try to do impact investments to the extent that I can. You know, I have some invested in Equal Exchange, Worker-Owned Co-op. There's a local CDFI, Blue Hub, Community Development Financial Institution. Every community has one. You can buy an investment note at your local CDFI, and they will put that money to good use. You can go to good banks, like Amalgamated Bank, which is a union-founded bank, and they work with workers. They're very much supported by unions. They have certificates of deposit right now. They're paying 5%. So, yeah, there are choices out there. You have to go on a journey. They're not quite as easy as clicking and investing in IBM, but there are choices out there, and we can find advisors who can help us sort our way through these. And to the extent that we can, do positive impact investments.
Two things. One, it's somewhat relieving to know you have some Wall Street investments. I'm like, okay, Marjorie's normal too.
That's right.
And then I will say, I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out Aaron Axelrod and our team at Lyft Economy with Sustainable Economies Law Center and others created the Next Egg. So thenextegg.org. And it's like a retirement sort of, what do we do with the next economy framework around retirement? So if listeners are interested, they can check
that
out.
That's wonderful. That's really great. Yeah, thanks for that.
Well, what if we turned to some of the alternative economic models, or like, what are some of the solutions that you're seeing that can address this problem of wealth supremacy?
Sure. Yeah. So in wealth supremacy, I really talk about system change. And the current system we have is all about, I mean, corporations are about maximizing gains to shareholders, which is 89% of shares are held by the wealthiest 10%. It's all about maximizing returns to investors. And we know that those are predominantly a wealthy few. So what would it be to have a system where capital is not at the center, but life is at the center? And where is that emerging? Because my perception as a journalist watching this space and a theorist working in this space for a couple of decades is that people instinctively know we need something different. We need houses we can afford. You know, there's co-housing, there's community land trusts where the community owns the land and families and individuals can own the houses, which are permanently affordable because you don't have to pay for the land, and they get 99-year leases. So in the 2008 downturn, community land trusts had foreclosure rates that were about one-fifth those of ordinary mortgages. So they didn't go belly up because these were affordable homes and they stay affordable. Worker ownership, you know, you mentioned earlier that my colleagues and I helped design and launch the fund for employee ownership at the Evergreen Cooperatives. And the Evergreen Cooperatives it's a network of worker-owned firms. Our organization helped develop those a number of years ago in Cleveland, and they hire from the inner city, primarily people of color. There's a large worker-owned commercial laundry, and it's supported by anchor institutions. So these are not standalone entities, but you're starting to create a system at the local level. So you have worker ownership, you have anchors that want to support this worker-owned laundry, and Cleveland Clinic uses it as their primary laundry because they do such good work. And there's 200 jobs at this commercial laundry. And when workers do well and they have a good year, they get profit sharing at the end of the year. Some years it's been 8,000, some years it's been 11,000. That's real money when you're working at a laundry, you know, putting sheets through machines. And this changes the lives of these families who say, oh my gosh, you know, my dad or my mom is an owner of this business. So worker ownership, that's a good model. Public ownership is also needed. 85% of Americans now get their water from municipally or cooperatively owned water utilities. And the evidence is that there's better quality and lower rates. That's also true of publicly owned or cooperatively owned electricity, which is better service and lower rates than investor ownership. So, you know, it's interesting, Ryan, because what I have seen and what we've seen at the Democracy Collaborative is that these, we call them democratic economy models, are superior if superior means serving human well-being and not extracting as much as you can for investors. Worker-owned firms are far less likely to lay people off, about one-fourth as much. They pay somewhat better wages, and workers come away with substantially more retirement savings, more than $100,000 per person on average. So, yeah, I guess what I would say is that there are a number of models out there. Public banks are another one. There's a growing movement for public banks. Impact investing, at its best, is, of course, a democratic economy movement. So there are lots of these siloed activities, Ryan, that are working. They're superior in their impacts. And you put them together and they start to add up to a system. They start to look like a next system that is centered on life and not on capital.
You know, you mentioned in your bio around working with certified B corporations who are employee owned. And I'm pretty involved in the B Corp movement. I'm curious, what were some of the results or what did you find in that research you did?
You know, that was really fascinating, Ryan, because no one had ever come up with a complete list of employee owned B Corps. I don't know if our list was complete, but it was as complete as we can make it. And we found more than 50 of these firms. And we put together research on their social impact and their ecological impact. And when we looked at their B scores, for example, and we compared worker-owned B Corps to regular B Corps and then to regular firms. And it was something like 8 out of 10 of these worker-owned B Corps had been declared best for the world in a couple of different years. And so they were head and shoulders above even B Corps, which are themselves head and shoulders above ordinary businesses in terms of social impact. And so a company that has a purpose of serving the public good, serving many stakeholders, and it has broad-based ownership, you know, rooted in the company itself, that is a next generation enterprise. That is showing what companies could be in a democratic economy. And I think it's important, Ryan, that there's not just one design element, right? In my book, Owning Our Future, I talk about the five design elements of ownership design. I mean, there's purpose, there's governance, there's ownership, there's networks, and there's capital. How do you get capital into these things? What are the networks that support them? Like B Corps are a network, cooperatives are a network. And so, you know, the more design elements you have supporting social mission, the more effective a company you're going to have. And so these employee-owned B Corps were a dramatic demonstration of that premise.
So Marjorie, what are you most excited about these days? Like, what's really getting you up out of bed in the morning?
Yeah, well, so what I'm excited about, I mean, we're at the Democracy Collaborative, we're exploring what comes out of this book. Where do we take this work? And we're looking at what we call a next system of capital. A lot of people are working on ownership, and that's, we need a great ownership transition. And this is something that I've worked on, others have worked on at Democracy Collaborative, and that's clearly needed. But we also need a next system of capital. Capital is not going to go away, and it shouldn't. And so is it possible that you could have an entire system, modern, sophisticated financial system, where serving life is at the center rather than just maximizing your own private wealth? Well, yeah, I think it is possible. We did a convening about a year ago. We brought together 15 experts and we looked at a variety of pathways to a next system of capital. Debt forgiveness is one. There's some very exciting work in debt forgiveness. Impact investing and local investing is another. And, you know, we need a new system of banking, a new kind of Federal Reserve, the People's Fed, as Robert Hockett from Cornell has envisioned. So there's, we were looking at what have visionaries devised that can take us in a pathway to a next system of capital. So we're looking at how to step into that work and take that forward. So that's what I'm excited about. I think, and here's how I think about it, Ryan. You know, you talked about how we don't want to demonize wealthy people. We absolutely do not, because I think wealthy people are vitally needed in this work of transformation. Investors are needed. You know, executives are needed, wealthy persons of inheritance are needed. Some of the most radical and effective people in working for transformation are persons of wealth. I feel very fortunate to know a number of these. And so this is true of capital also. Capital is not inherently evil. You know, we need to have it. In fact, right now, financial assets are 5 times GDP. They used to be equal to GDP back in the 1950s when I was a kid. And now they're 5 times GDP. This is a force 5 times larger than all of the economic activity in the real economy. We need that force on our side. We know that labor has been systematically disempowered. Companies fight labor unions. They get rid of full-time jobs. They send jobs overseas. They turn jobs into gig work. So labor has been systematically disempowered. Labor has always been the force for progressive change in politics, and it's been diminished. We need capital on our side. And so what does that look like? How do you do that? And this is some exciting work that I want to be digging into.
Yeah. I was like, what's the answer, Marjorie? How do you do it? But I think that's what you're doing.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. You know, I think, first of all, you need to articulate the vision and the excitement. You know, a whole system of a next system of capital that aimed at serving life. You know, that is exciting. And capital can be a liberatory force. I recently had the good fortune to make an investment in the Boston Impact Initiative. This is run by a friend of mine, Deborah Fries, and she is a person of, you know, she has some means, and she is working with entrepreneurs of color and people who are managing funds that serve entrepreneurs of color. And so they're trying to put capital in the hands of people who don't ordinarily have access to it. We know that when people of color run companies, they're more likely to hire people of color. And they're also building their own wealth for themselves, for their families, and that's going to benefit their children. So you're creating wealth where it should be, where it's needed. And as an investor, to be able to support that, I was just thrilled. It's a new thing that she has a note that you can invest in. So one of the things I've been sort of noodling with money managers and advisors is the idea of subversive investing. What if we were investing to subvert the dominant paradigm? What'd that look like? You know, right now, I think there's this idea that impact investing is risky. It's small. You maybe put 5% of your portfolio in it, but we're all invested in Amazon and Google and these big guys, which represent this huge swath of the market. So it's crazy. You need to turn this on its head. So what if we said whether investments are productive or speculative? When we invest in Wall Street, those are speculative investments. That money doesn't reach those firms. It's not productive investment. You're just buying stock, hoping it'll go up. That's speculation. So if we could just see in our portfolio statements, let's see, you know, about 80% of my portfolio is speculative and about maybe 5% is actually productive. You know, just as a form of seeing clearly what's happening, I think that's one thing. Then emphasizing impact investments is another, and also avoiding the really extractive forms of investment, like hedge funds or private equity, which tend to be opaque and nobody knows what's going in there. Harvard is about 2/3 invested in hedge funds and private equity.
I bet.
And you know,
so places like Boston Children's Hospital are invested in like VC firms with their endowments.
And nobody really knows what's going on there. They're not required to report. It's not transparent. So what if we encouraged our institutional investors to get out of those investments, or at the very least to engage and insist, as some people are, there's a movement to do this, to insist that private equity, if it's going to hold fossil fuel firms, it needs to have a plan to wind down production. So starting to use our investments as a way to build a next system.
Yeah, it's almost, I'm imagining some sort of ecosystem play, maybe another version of the, you know, Cleveland model or something, but it's like a in the financial world, potentially.
We're just starting. We're just starting. So stay tuned.
Fair enough. Well, in the last couple of questions here, what do you need right now? And how can listeners help you grow the next economy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I encourage people to read the book, read Wealth Supremacy. We're talking for an hour, Ryan, and it's very informal, but a book I think really helps people walk more deeply into these ideas, which might seem frightening or confusing or exciting, but a book is a very organized way to step into some very exciting territory. So I encourage people, and I make a dollar a book, Ryan. So this is my get rich quick scheme. You know, in fact, we can offer a 30% discount to readers. If you go to BK Connection, that's the publisher, Bear Kohler, bkconnection.com, and put in the code FRIENDS, FRIENDS. So people watching this podcast are friends. Get 30% off if you're interested in the book. That's one thing. I'm a great believer in the power of books. And I think the second thing is, let's talk to each other. It's very easy to think that the most important thing is positive action. We need to go out and take positive action. I would argue that first, changing our minds is where we begin. How did Black Lives Matter get started? How did feminism get started? And we come together, we talk to each other, we have shared concepts, we have our shared aha moments. It's those collective aha moments where change really begins. You know, once you see that climate change is real, then you do what you can to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And so seeing is where we need to begin. We need to read, talk to each other, and become educated, because there are a lot of myths in the system that we're in, and we need to open up our own minds, I think, to begin and not be too intimidated by it all. We don't need to run out tomorrow and solve it. Let's just talk to each other first. That's where I would encourage people to start.
I love that, because I feel like sometimes the problems seem so vast that it's either, you know, under, you know, maybe I'm under my bed in the fetal position, mm-hmm. you know, or frantically running around and yelling at people to do something, neither of which are particularly effective.
No, I think that's right. I mean, we have to be patient with ourselves, because the change that's needed is big. It's a civilizational shift. So I would say a couple of things. One is that we do not need to create the conditions for the demise of this system. It's doing that itself. It is not a sustainable system. And what cannot be sustained will not be sustained. So who knows what shape that's going to be, you know, collapse. I kind of doubt that. Maybe more like a, you know, series of little crises. So the system is rickety and unsustainable. And I think also the democratic economy is emerging all around us. It's farther along than most people realize. It's workable. It's feasible. It's superior, as I said, if our goal is well-being and not maximum extraction. So I think as we develop and support this emerging economy, it can be there that we will find pathways that will open up as we move ahead. I wouldn't say exactly that I'm optimistic, but I would say that I'm hopeful.
I like that. I like the distinction. Well, Marjorie, thank you so much. Where can folks learn more about your work? Website, social media, other things you want to shout out?
Yeah, wealthsupremacy.org has other writings of mine. You can read a summary of the book there. That's a great place to start.
Awesome. I love it. Well, thank you so much for joining. You know, I should get you on more than once every 7 years, so I'll have to get you back. But it's been a pleasure, and thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Ryan. This was fun.
Next Economy Now is a production of Lyft Economy. To listen to all of our episodes, go to lifteconomy.com/podcast. That's lifteconomy.com/podcast. You can also sign up for our monthly newsletter at lifteconomy.com/newsletter. Please also rate and review our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.